Joining me now, Dr. Hunter Baker. You can find him pretty much all over the place at Hunter Baker. Joining us from Union University, but I'm betting that you are joining us probably not from the university campus, and things are not sort of operating as usual.
Things are not operating as usual. However, your faithful correspondent does have to go to the university because I'm the Dean of Arts and Sciences, and the university is still operating. So faculty, you know, some faculty are there using the technology. Others are at home. The students, many of them are in the dorms. We just aren't gathering for classes, you know, putting people in small rooms together, or large rooms and large numbers of people. And so, you know, but I kind of have to be there as a symbol that we're still operating. We're still doing this thing.
Okay. Well, we're glad. I mean, that's the reality, right? People are still doing their core essential things, particularly in the area of education. They're just doing it differently. And I'm thankful for technology because we would really not be able to do what we are currently doing and carry on with the education of generations were it not for the technology that's available today. So, you know, I'm thankful for that.
Yeah, we at least have an option. I mean, you know, it's obviously not optimal. And as you know, it's interesting, you know, all these universities put out a statement, very sort of a casual statement, that we're moving our operations online. But the reality is, that I think 80% or more of the American professoriate are not ready to do that. And so it is a very steep learning curve. And, you know, I'm a fairly tech savvy person, but I haven't been teaching online. So even for the one class that I teach, I've had a pretty rapid learning curve, a steep, rapid learning curve. And, you know, I was scrambling even yesterday because when this semester started, I had set up a highly participative model for my class. If I was doing one of my more typical lecture type classes, it would have been easy. But so I had to figure out a way to model a participative class online. That's a challenge. And a lot of people are going to be facing that.
Absolutely. I think that becoming students of the next generation who actually know how to use some of these online platforms better than some of us do, like we need to become students in some cases of our students. All right. I want to talk with you, Hunter, about why America is a little different in terms of our response to the coronavirus. What is it that is different about America in terms of the way we have structured ourselves and the way that we function that actually makes our response to the coronavirus unique and different?
Well, I think a lot of people have struggled with this question of how maybe dictatorial Donald Trump should be about it. You know, sometimes you almost see outrage that he is not just sort of centralizing all command and control and dealing with the virus. But the problem is that is not really the way the United States is set up to work. The United States is set up to work in a decentralized fashion. Federalism is something that sounds like the federal government controls everything, but what it really means is that authority is divided between the federal government and the states. And so so a lot of the response to this crisis has been driven by decisions at the local and state levels. So that's just a little bit different, right? I mean, it's funny because people who you would argue have been terrified that Donald Trump would be some kind of dictator are now openly yearning for it. So that's kind of the unique thing about the U.S. We're not made to be a super top-down country, but a response to a crisis like this may eventually demand that. In fact, we may already be there.
Let's just take the response of the governor of the state of New York as an example of what we're talking about. So where a few weeks ago, if the Republican president of the United States of America had told the governor of New York that the federal government was coming in and taking over and going to tell them how to do things and going to, really going to upend New York City itself, and you know, on and on and on. I feel like the Democrat governor of New York would have resisted that vociferously. And yet now we see him inviting the military in to support his hospital network. We see him being openly critical of the federal government for not taking over and intervening in ways that he, as a governor, was allowed to have the liberty to do. It is challenging. I do think, Hunter, it reveals what would happen. What would happen should, let's say, that particular individual ever become the president of the United States, because he clearly thinks that as president of the United States, you have the right to march all over state rights. Like, I do think right. There's a conversation in here that gives us a picture into what life might look like in the United States of America if a person who thinks we should have socialized medicine and a person who thinks that the federal government should have the right to tell individual locales exactly what to do and how to do it, we get a little window into that.
Yeah, I think that's true. But, you know, the other thing is that some of this reveals to us the nature of this crisis. I am married to a physician, and, you know, I have gone through all of the stages. At one point, I made a Facebook post about the stages of grief over the coronavirus. And one of the stages of grief is, you know, it's the flu. It's not even as bad as the flu, right? You know, why are we doing all this? And what I have come to realize is that the problem is this, they call this a novel virus, meaning that it is new to human beings. And that means we don't have immunity. And so it presents this opportunity for spreading at a rate much faster than our health system can accommodate. And that's what's happened in Italy, where you have people kind of dying in hallways and, you know, there are not enough ventilators for people who need them and things like that. And so all of this really authoritarian, almost sort of response is in an attempt to meet that crisis. And by definition, almost any crisis of a large enough magnitude would result in this kind of additional power for the federal government. So I'm kind of not surprised it's happening. This is a pretty big deal.
Yeah. Okay. So words of wisdom on Mornings with Carmen on the 18th of March by Hunter Baker. This is really a pretty big deal. Yeah. With that, we're going to take a very brief break. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about a little bit why America is also different because of our free market economy and the impacts. Then we're going to discuss some of the impacts related to that. And we're also going to talk about the response of the government. What is happening in Washington, D.C.? There are three bills. One has already passed. Two are, a second one is on its way through. A third one is yet being conceived. We're going to talk a little bit about that when we come back. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen. Okay, because people are asking, I have dutifully scrolled through Hunter Baker's Facebook feed. Here are the stages of grief related to the coronavirus, according to Dr. Hunter Baker, with whom we are speaking now. Everyone has to go through the stages of grief on the coronavirus. Stage one, this is another one of those international problems that will go away soon. Stage two, that would be denial. Stage two, it's the flu. It's the flu. Just not as bad. Why is everybody freaking out? Stage three, why am I out of toilet paper? Stage four, I now understand that if everyone gets it at once, there will be people dying in hallways because 1% of 100 million is still a huge number. Yes, math. I think stage four could have just been math. Stage five, my body bubble is 6 feet in every direction. Mm-hmm. Stage six, why is my Amazon statement so freaking huge? There you go. Amen. There's the
That's what happens when you stay home. Yeah, when you stay home, the Amazon bill gets large.
My credit score like dropped. I'm like, what's going on? They're like, well, your numbers are going up in ways they've not gone up before. I'm like, that's interesting. Okay, so let's talk about what makes America unique, a little bit different in terms of our response, because we have the economy that we have.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and this is actually an occasion to be grateful. You look at somewhere like Italy. Italy has, quote unquote, universal health care. But a lot of times, universal health care means scarcity and waiting and lack of availability. One thing that's interesting, so in Italy, they're overwhelmed. In the U.S., one thing I'm grateful for, our healthcare system is expensive. There's no question about that. But it has certain market forces in it, and that is going to serve us well in this crisis because we probably have per capita triple the intensive care unit capacity of a place like Italy. So if we get swamped with this thing like Italy, and hopefully we're avoiding that with all the steps that we've taken, we have a much greater capacity to deal with it than they do.
All right, let's talk about how our federal government is responding. Phase one bill passed earlier this month. That was an $8.3 billion sort of emergency package response. A phase two bill has now passed the House and is going to the Senate. Tell us what's in that.
Well, let's just bring it all together, right? I mean,
okay.
That's because you like math.
I don't really like math. So go ahead, bring it all together.
I want to deal with the variety of approaches that they are taking. The problem is that you're constantly aiming at economic growth, right? You're constantly trying to expand the number of things that people can do and to grow the size of the pie and to make everybody better off. But when those numbers start to roll in the wrong way, when those numbers start to go backwards, we call it recession or depression, that can be extremely painful, right? Because what that does is that results in lots of people losing their jobs, lots of businesses not being able to pay their bills and having to close. And it's just like a big domino type reaction, right? And so you can easily see how if the restaurants have to shut down their dining areas, if the theaters have no one in them, I think I just read that AMC Theater is going to shut down. If people are not traveling, all of the airlines are at risk. Hotels are at risk. Everybody who's in the hospitality or conference industry is at risk. So you can just imagine the effects that spread out through the economy when that happens. So with that, they're trying to find a way to reduce the damage that comes from our response to the virus. I mean, we're doing this thing to try to stop the spread of the virus, but the economic impacts are powerful. And so what's happening, that's part of why some people are denying it so strongly, is because they don't want to see us crater the economy. But I'm not sure that we have any other choice. And so the federal government, through the Fed, through Congress, is trying to flood the economy with government money to try to retard the economic effects that are going to hit us. And so those things range from money to particular industry, to loans to small businesses, to the Fed buying lots of securities to try to prop up the market, to maybe eventually sending $1,000 checks to every American. I mean, the number of possibilities is great. And that's what you're seeing right now is the Fed and Congress and the president rushing to try to find a way to keep the economy rolling while we're all staying at home.
All right, let's talk about some of just the impacts that people are experiencing. You know, just when you're just talking with, you know, in your casual everyday conversations, what would you say for most people is the greatest surprise or the greatest disruption or the thing they're having the most difficult time figuring out how to deal with?
I mean, the one that strikes me as the most obvious, and maybe this is from my own experience, is childcare. As soon as the schools close down, that creates a very big problem for a lot of people. Think about the number of families where the husband and wife work. That's my family. That has been my family. And I think about every time the schools closed because of snow or, you know, some teacher day or whatever else, it was a crisis for us and we had to figure out how to address it. We didn't have grandparents living in town or anything like that. And so if you just think about the schools of this country closing down for a month and maybe more, what that does to working parents, I think that's probably the biggest disruption in addition to the economic effects that I talked about.
And I think that both the phase two and phase three bills that Congress is moving through do seek to address that concern and that issue that people are having, you know, paid leave, and part of that paid leave would be in relationship to how are they going to provide childcare for their kids while they're out of school. The disruption for students is going to be significant. And so we're going to want to circle back around with you on that topic in the coming weeks. So we look forward to those ongoing conversations. Thank you so much, Hunter Baker from Union University. You guys can find him on all the social medias at Hunter Baker. Obviously, check out his Facebook feed because he seems to be very active there. And that's where you can find the stages of grief of the coronavirus that I read through. He's also got some fun videos posted there by academicians who are trying to figure out how to actually go online. It's funny. All right. Hey, thanks, Hunter.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. Okay, I'm going to give you a few sort of in the meantime headlines here very quickly. The Syrian civil war has entered its 10th year. When we think about the things that we're dealing with here, I just want you to consider that 10 years ago, Syria entered into a civil war that didn't just internally displace people, but took the lives of many, many people. The disruption that the Syrians have experienced and the countries surrounding them has been enormous. You think about the refugee flows and on and on. The locusts are still on the move. You remember that? We talked about this a few weeks ago. Well, seven East African countries have now been decimated by these locust swarms. In Pakistan, farmers are pleading for help. The headline reads, "Our children will starve, and then so will you." So we have headlines related to the locusts. If you just want to Google locusts, you want some news that's a little different than coronavirus, and you want some pray the news headlines today, Google the word locust. It is headed for Israel. It will arrive in Israel by Passover. I know, it gives us an opportunity to consider the gospel. It gives us an opportunity to talk about the fact that shadows and darkness absolutely, absolutely suggest that there's a light source, a powerful light source. You and I know the one who is the light. We know the name of Jesus. We know the hope of salvation. We know the good news of the gospel. And these are the days in which we have the opportunity to share him with others. So never forget that you are a person who knows the hope of salvation and that many, many others do not. And so when we face the news of the day with faith, others face it with fear. And we are the ones who can help them to understand that in the end of all of this, the fear of the Lord is actually the beginning of wisdom. Let's start those conversations today. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen. We'll be right back.